Welcome to another bonus episode of the Fertility Podcast. If you missed the chance to go to the British Science Museum in London on the 25th of July, which was celebrating Louise Brown's 40th birthday, well, I've got the audio for you. So I hope you enjoy it. I'll put a quick link at the end of the episode where you can find out more details about the exhibition and a conversation that I had with Louise talking about her story. As we continue celebrating 40 years of IVF, let's keep talking. If you want to share your story, email natalie@thefertilitypodcast.com and be sure to subscribe to this podcast to keep hearing other people's stories as well as expert interviews from fertility experts around the globe.
Roger Highfield, one of the directors here. Welcome to Lates. Happy 70th NHS, happy 40th IVF, and most important of all, happy birthday, Louise Brown. Now, we're also here to celebrate our latest exhibition, IVF, 6 Million Babies Later, which has been curated by Connie Orbach and Ling Lee. And it tells the amazing story of how a fringe technology was at first hated and then embraced. It's a story of science which has paved the way to deeper understanding of embryo development, stem cells, artificial embryos, and more. But most of all, it's a story about the most fundamental human instinct of all, which is to have children. So let's first of all welcome our first guest who will talk about IVF science, Professor Roger Gosden. Coming up, Roger. Roger holds doctorates from Edinburgh and Cambridge, where he worked with Bob Edwards, who won, obviously, the Nobel Prize for IVF. Roger was a research director and professor of reproductive science at universities in Edinburgh, Leeds, McGill, Virginia, and then finally at Cornell University in New York. Has published about 300 science articles, book and journal editor, and has lately become an indie publisher as well. And now to our special birthday guest, who's almost 40 years old because she was born just before midnight on this day, 1978, Oldham, England. Please welcome the world's first test tube baby and miracle baby, Louise Brown. So, Louise, let's just start off with the key personalities in the story. Let's forget about Edwards and Purdy and Steptoe, your mum and dad. Tell me about what they were thinking in the run-up to dealing with the team in Oldham.
Well, mum went to her doctor with depression, and they found that the underlying factor was that mum wasn't able to conceive for about 9 years. So she went to see a local specialist who then said unfortunately she couldn't do anything for mum and dad. But she'd heard that there was a gynecologist up in Oldham that was doing some tests and that she would put mum in contact with Patrick.
And so your mother, I mean, IVF today is fairly grueling. Was she a made of steel? Was she a tough kind of person, or did she just not know what she was getting herself into?
Mum was a very shy and quiet lady. She hated any attention, but all she wanted was a baby, and she would have done anything.
So, Roger, just to go to the scientific backstory to this, there's a long chain of research, isn't there, behind this sort of breakthrough moment. Just give us a sense of just briefly, the advances that got to the point where the first in vitro fertilization would work, because it was attempted before, of course.
Okay. First of all, happy birthday.
Uh-huh.
From America. From your friends in America.
Okay.
Yes, the story really begins in Boston, Massachusetts, where people had this idea. It was a man called John Rock, and with Miriam Menken, a bit like a Gene Purdy figure.
Yeah.
And they worked together in the 40s, but we don't think that they actually succeeded in producing viable embryos. And then what happened was that John Rock and Gregory Pincus got distracted, and they developed the contraceptive pill.
Right.
And so then...
one end of the spectrum to the other, basically.
That's right. And there were many claims in animals that IVF had been achieved. in rabbits and other species. But there were always doubts about that. And one of the problems was about sperm maturation, because it was thought that they have to reside in the female tract. And that was difficult to arrange for human IVF. But the first convincing case of IVF in any species was conducted by a man called M.C. Chang. He was Chinese. He actually trained in Cambridge, and he achieved this with the Pinkus in his lab in outside Boston. And so that was in the rabbit in 1959, and Bob Edwards was very much influenced by that paper. He saw it could be done in other species, including human. Although when they started the work on human, there were only, I think, three species that it had been achieved in, and they were all rodents. Mm. We, in the lab, I think were doubtful that it was possible.
Well, this is the critical thing. Before we return to Louise, just give us a snapshot of how the medical establishment of the late 70s regarded Steptoe, Edwards, and Purdy.
Well, Jean Purdy was protected by the men, I think, and she was a tremendously loyal person, but I don't think she got any of the heat. Steptoe was quite used to it because he was the pioneer of laparoscopy in this country, and people thought it was dangerous because there was a hot lamp in the early days. A man in Reading University developed the cold light, and he used it extensively in the 60s and was having lots of visitors, many from overseas. So he was ridiculed for that technology. And, of course, Edwards was said to be crazy, really, to even try this, even believe that it was possible. Although probably around that time he knew more about reproductive biology and embryology than anyone else in the world, he had a huge appetite for learning.
And I seem to remember some really big figures were doubtful, people like Jim Watson, of DNA fame, Robert Winston, who became, and so on and so forth. Yeah. But, Louise, you're in the kind of curious position. You were the star of this, but, of course, you wouldn't have realized what's going on for very obvious reasons. Tell me about the moment that you first realized that you were unusual compared with other kids and so on.
Just before I went to school, just after my fourth birthday, Mum and Dad sat me down and showed the video of my birth and said that I was born slightly different to other children. And that's about all I sort of took in from that. And then the rest was listening to Mum and Dad be interviewed by the press. And as I got older, you sort of understand a little bit more. You get sex education at school. I think I must have been probably about 13, 14 when it actually sort of the penny dropped and I realised what it all meant.
And in fact, in the audience, I think we've got John Webster, who was one of the team that delivered you. John, I don't know where you are. You can wait. Okay, John's waving. So John brought you into the help bring you into the world. That's right, isn't it, John? Yes. So what about your peers at school? Did they tease you about it? Did they take it in a sort of sanguine, relaxed way?
Not really. I mean, I went to school with the same group of children, right from primary, infant, primary, and then senior. So once everybody got over the initial, that's Louise Brown, it was fine, apart from if anybody new started. And then everybody would be like, who's going to tell them? Who's going to tell them? I said, well, it's not going to be me.
But the stakes for Louise's birth for the scientific team were sky high, weren't they, Roger? Can you give a feel for what would have been going through their heads with this first pregnancy?
Well, probably John Webster would be the best person to tell us that story. And if I can paraphrase what he told me, was that there was a feeling that when your mum was being wheeled into the operating theatre, there was a tremendous sense of anxiety. Because although they had done all the tests they possibly could on your mum to make sure that you were fine, they could not be 100% sure because it was the first time. nobody could be absolutely sure. And the stakes were so high, not only for you and for your health, but also for them, for their careers, for their reputation. And because right in front of the operating table were cameras, film cameras, and they were all ready to launch out into the world the next day. So if there had been a disaster, it would have been the most humiliating defeat probably in medical history.
How many years do you think it would have set back the development of technology if it had all gone wrong?
It's hard. I think we would have it now. The Australians were hard on the heels of the Oldham team, but it certainly would have raised a spectre, especially in this country. Possibly instead of this country celebrating the first birth, it would be some other country, is my guess.
And I suppose we should also mention that, you know, that there are the Oldham notebooks, and the data over 10 years, it's kind of amazing in a way. When I look at the numbers, you've got 282 anonymous women, 457 attempted egg retrievals, 331 attempted fertilizations, 221 embryos to give 5 pregnancies and 2 successful births. Mm. So there's this amazing group of hundreds of women who underwent this procedure, who sort of we forget about a bit, but it's extraordinary. And I guess Jean Purdy, I seem to remember, played a critical role in keeping up spirits in what must have been quite difficult circumstances.
Yes, she was Edward's assistant, and she was totally meticulous. And this is a characteristic that you really want in an embryologist. So she was really playing a role of a nurse's heart, but not a nurse's role. She never was the nurse. She was the scientific assistant. Mm-hmm. But she was a person of great compassion. And I just discovered a few days ago that she suffered from infertility herself. She was a single lady, mm-hmm. and she suffered from endometriosis and had a lot of pain every cycle. So it makes it rather more tender, I think.
So, Louise, what was your relationship with Steptoe Edwards and Purdy?
They were like sort of extended family. Bob and Patrick were like grandfathers to me. I don't remember Patrick as well as Bob, because I was 10 when Patrick passed away. I've got not any memories of Jean, but Mum used to always talk about her and said how she was so lovely and
she
caring.
She died even earlier, didn't she?
Yeah, I think it was 85.
Yeah,
so I was about 7, yes. Yeah. But I mean, I will always be very grateful and thankful for them giving me life and giving 6 million of us life. So,
and also Natalie, your sister. Tell me a bit about Natalie, because she's in the history books as well for a different sort of reason.
Natalie was the 40th from Bournehall, and she was also the first IVF baby to have children of her own. So, and she's now got 5.
Does she, you know, would she like to have some of the limelight as well? Is she happy to leave it all to you?
I think so, yeah. Yes. I mean, I think when she was younger, she was probably, we used to do a lot of interviews together. I think now, though, I think she's quite happy to just let me get on with it, really.
And you've actually, you've been all over the place. It's an extraordinary anniversary. And just tell us a bit about your travels to...
Before we actually got to today, I've had happy birthday sung to me on 4 different continents so far this year. we went to Japan. We've been to Chicago. We've been to Marrakesh, Barcelona, and finally today.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to go through it all over again at least a couple more times. Mm-hmm. So... What about the state of IVF today? Roger, it's still not hugely efficient, is it? Which sort of surprises me a little bit. And, just talk us through the state of the art and how things are heading.
Well, as you described, it was very, very inefficient at the start. But like a lot of technologies, it's a very slow start, and then gradually it creeps up because more and more people are trying it and learning and then sharing the information. One of the things that you look back on in a bit of horror was that in the very early days when there were new clinics being set up, some were really quite good, but some had nearly zero success, and they should have been closed down. But the rate climbs, and I think in your exhibition it says 25% success rate. In some countries it's a little bit higher, some countries a little bit lower. If you look at the American data, and I'm not sure what this country shows, probably similar, is that you see a creeping increase each year of about just under 1% more successful each year as a result of technology. It's a sort of Moore's law of semiconductors, except much, much slower than that. But it is improving. It will never be 100%, though, because we've got the limitations of nature, and human fertility is very inefficient for reasons that we don't fully understand. There are evolutionary explanations, perhaps.
So is it just tweaking things like the nutrient media, or are there fundamental new technologies that could advance things and make them more, make it more efficient?
Yeah, so there's a lot of innovation. A number of so-called add-ons that are unproven that are offered to patients. I personally, if I was looking for treatment, wouldn't use them until I saw rather more concrete evidence for them. There's video microscopy to monitor your embryo continuously, which I think probably helps clinics which are not quite so good. It is still a technology that depends upon having really green fingers. It involves handling embryos, taking enormous care over the environment, and that probably accounts for why there are differences between centers. But we can expect things to still improve, but they will never get to 100%. That's why most young couples would be told, well, you may not be successful this time, but if you try two or three times, then there's a very good chance of it. But, of course, the problem is that in many countries, it's expensive.
I'd say one of the things in the exhibition that gives me goosebumps, Louise, is the is one of the desiccators that was used to incubate you more than 40 years ago, which is, I mean, what do you feel when you look at your temporary home today?
It's very weird. Just to think that I started off in that little dish.
today, just tell us a bit about your life today, Louise, and you know, give a sense of, because obviously it's only when you encounter these anniversaries in the press that you think about these things, and 99% of your life has got nothing to do with IVF, I take it.
Yeah, I lead a very normal life. I work 9 to 5 as a freight forwarder in Bristol. I have 2 sons, a husband, and just normal, everyday things.
So it must be quite surreal to have this parallel existence.
Yeah, definitely.
So is it a burden or is it fun?
No, I enjoy it. I enjoy meeting all the people. I enjoy meeting the families that have had to go through it and the outcome, the babies. I just like meeting all the people. So
you go to lots of events where obviously IVF success rates are discussed and technology. Is there anything, I mean, I know, you know, that you're not that interested in the science, but you know, it's an intensely personal business, and are there issues that mean a lot to you in terms of the availability of IVF and things like that?
Well, I know in the beginning when Bob, Patrick and Jean started it all, they just wanted it so that everybody could access it, and that would just be really the main thing, that it is available to everybody.
Yeah, and that really seems to be a persistent theme, doesn't it, Roger, the postcode lottery and so on and so forth.
Well, it is, yes, that's right. I'm less familiar with the situation in this country now. But you'll see in different countries, different percentages of children who are born by this technology, ranging up to 5-6% in some countries. The higher ones are the ones where there's government funding. The lower ones are the ones where it's private funding. And I have to say that the USA is very low on this list, even though there are a lot of prominent centers. It's very expensive there.
Now, you did a paper just recently, Roger, looking into the future. Tell us a bit about how many IVF children and children that indirectly would have come from IVF you can see by the end of the century. Just talk us through it a little bit.
Well, on your exhibition it says 6 million babies. I actually think it's probably a bit more than that,
yeah.
Maybe as much as 8 million. But we chose 6 million then to make a projection like the WHO or the United Nations does for world population to the end of the century. And I work with two mathematically more gifted people than me. One is in the audience, my son, and the other is a mathematician, statistician in Australia. And so we wanted to get some idea of what the legacy of Edwards and Steptoe was in terms of numbers. I was much more interested in the total numbers of people who owed their existence to IVF, either directly, year by year, to the year 2100, or indirectly as their children and grandchildren. They wouldn't have existed otherwise. Probably clinic directors and companies would be more interested in just the number of conceptions by in vitro. The numbers are quite staggering, and we used extremely conservative numbers. And so at the very lower end, it turned out to be about 160 million by that, but could be 400 million. And we left out Africa, where fertility, although it's very high naturally, there are a lot of infertile people there, a tremendous stigma. And so probably one day they will be added to the statistics too. So the numbers are very considerable, actually.
So as a percentage of the global population at the end of the century, what are we talking, a few percent or something like that?
More than a few percent. And in some countries like Denmark, which does much more IVF than here, maybe 10% of the population will be conceived in vitro or owing their existence to in vitro.
I suppose another, since we're in the museum and we're interested in telling amazing stories through the era and, eras, and of course you were both united just a few days ago in a memorial for Jean Purdy. Just Louise, tell me a little bit about about your encounter in Grantchester last Friday.
It just really brings home that it wasn't just the two people, it was three of them. And it's wonderful to see people together to create the memorial. I mean, it's a lovely, beautiful stone, and she deserves it.
And in fact, Bob Edwards spent a lot of time trying to correct the heroic Steptoe and Edwards story, didn't he, Roger?
Mm. He did. She never sought the limelight, though. I can tell you a little story about my first encounter with her, though, that you might be interested in, Louise. I was a green student in Cambridge, and I went out for lunch one day, and I brought home to the lab some sausage rolls. They were cold, so I looked around the lab for somewhere to warm them up. I put them in this oven. The oven was 150 degrees, so I knew it was going to be ready pretty soon. So I put them in there. There was a lot of other stuff in the back, and closed it, and then went back to my desk. And then I heard this woman shriek. And Jean had opened it and got this tremendous gust of savory odor, which had perfused all through the glassware, on the pipettes and the dishes and everything that she was going to be putting embryos in. So I always wanted to know whether you had an unusual liking for sausage rolls.
They're okay, but okay. I don't go mad on them.
Well, that was a very surreal and unexpected twist to the conversation. I think actually we should try to get a few questions from the audience. So I don't know whether we got some roving mics. They're just, I've slightly caught them unawares. Here we are. Put your hand up and we'll try and get a couple of questions. So we've got one here. Now forgive me if I can't see you because it's quite, the lights are quite blinding. Go on. Yeah, these two here. And do introduce yourself and fire away. Go on.
Hi, Louise. I'm Emma Mason. I'm the press officer for Human Reproduction Journal. Happy birthday. I just wanted to ask, when you were growing up in primary school and secondary school particularly, how did it feel knowing, you know, how did you personally feel knowing that you were the first ever, of, you know, first test tube baby ever, and how did that affect your interactions with your peers?
I don't think I really ever thought about it because Mum and Dad took me out of the spotlight when I started school. So the only things we ever did was what Bob and Patrick wanted us to do. So going through school, once everybody knew who I was, it was, I went to school with all the same people, so it was fine. When I got to my teenage years, I used to sort of think, when you're growing up and you're getting older, and I used to sort of lie in bed on a night and sometimes think, why me? But I think that was just more to do with growing up and just getting over your fears and things like that. So, yeah, that's sort of really how it didn't really affect me that much.
Let's have the next question. I hope there's a mic lined up. Oh, far away, sorry.
Hi there. This is just in relation to some of the wonderful images that are up behind you. So thank you so much to whoever created all of that. But there are some images up there of some the graduation of the embryo, is it? And it looks like it's going for quite a long time, sort of 9, 10, 11, 12 days.
That's
Did the embryo, was the embryo transferred a lot later than it is these days, which sort of only goes up to about a...
I can tell you a little bit about that. That was produced by Magda Zernica-Gertz's team in Cambridge. And I think I'm right in saying, Roger, until a few years ago, you could only grow human embryos for sort of 6 or 7 days in the lab. Magda is interested in what happens around the time of implantation, which happens later. But obviously, you're beginning to bump up against the 14-day limit. So she... there's another team in the Rockefeller have come up with different conditions to investigate this later, what's called the black box of human development that we don't really understand very well. It could be very important for things like miscarriage and so on. And there's obviously a bit of an ethical discussion now about whether we should stick to Mary Warnock's incredibly resilient 14-day limit or whether we should push it back a bit. So it's really for fundamental research rather than for IVF. I mean, I hope that's, since Roger's the real expert. But in fact, Roger, I should ask you, what are there key technologies around the corner or key developments? Because I seem to remember Bob Edwards felt that stem cell science grew naturally, or human stem cell science grew naturally out of his work. What kind of things capture your attention in terms of developments in the next couple of decades?
Well, one of the most exciting, some people might say scary, developments which would counter some genetic problems and also help people who are born without ovaries or testes is a technology which is being developed by one of our colleagues in Cambridge, with some very bright Japanese scientists. And basically, it is a technology which has been proven in mice and being developed gradually in human, where you might take a biopsy, like a piece of the skin, grow the cells in vitro. You might genetically manipulate it. For example, if you had inherited Huntington's disease or something like that, which is a inherited 50% people with a parent carrying it will get it. It's a stuttering mutation, CAG, the letters go. And correct that by gene editing and then develop these into primitive germ cells and then on from that to make eggs or sperm.
So you're okay, so you wouldn't, okay, you can, presumably, could you actually make sperm from a woman's skin sample? What about the,
why would you?
Well, I can think of some reasons.
But it is probably easier to make a sperm than an egg. Mm-hmm. An egg has a complicated history. For the sperm, you only need to make the nucleus, really, which has got just a half of the amount of DNA, and then use the technique of sperm injection, or ICSI, to inject it into an egg. So the male problem, which is often underestimated, could be solved more quickly, I think, than the female one.
Let's have a couple more questions from the audience. So we've got one just here, and there's another one to line up here far away. Yes, you're ready. Yeah.
Sorry, yes, my name's Simon. Just wondering again, from the images here, I can see that there's some kind of inflammatory media and religious kind of connotations as to, you know, the reason for doing this. I wanted to find out how that impacted, A, the research, and B, your life, and when did that actually change and become favorable?
What do you think of Her Majesty's Press, Louise?
Well,
how many hours have you got?
Mum and Dad received lots of more religious and weird things from when I was born, which I didn't find out about until I was much older. They did a good job of shielding that from me. Mm. But it didn't really have an impact on my life. Everybody is entitled to their own opinion, and just because I think something's wrong doesn't mean somebody else thinks something wrong, vice versa. So I just take it, everybody's entitled to their opinion.
I think we're in a remarkable position because of the hard work done by the philosopher Mary Warnock, with the advice of the embryologist Anne McLaren, who found a way to kind of reconcile, I think, two impossible things, which is pragmatism, how to give infertile couples, children, and then fundamentalism, which is, you know, the embryo and human development is sacred and something for God alone, and came up with that 14-day limit. I mean, I wouldn't say the war is over, is it, Roger? I mean, you're based in America. You must get this more vividly than anyone here in the UK.
You're right that the issue is really still about embryo research. And a lot of people who were opposed to the technology in the first place have accepted it and have seen that it's brought great joy to people. So people change their mind.
Louise's middle name, of course.
Yes, joy. So, you know, ethics is not something absolute. People evolve their views over time, but there's still opposition. And, of course, the Roman Catholic Church still forbids IVF because it believes, or the doctrine is, it wasn't always, I believe, that conception begins at fertilization. And yet many people ignore it who are faithful Catholics otherwise.
Of course, the science there is quite strange because at fertilization, there's a bit of a break before male and female DNA is mixed. So in the sense of an individual that you and I understand, you haven't really got an individual there at fertilization. Anyway, that's another scientific story. Let's have another question from the audience. We've got one down there, and I think there was someone itching. Go on.
Hi, Vaughan Jones. I'm a journalist, so part of Her Majesty's Press, I apologise. And also IVF warrior, and born in Bristol as well. And many happy returns, happy birthday. Question really about, you mentioned before that there's a 25%-ish success rate across the globe, which means, of course, there's a 75% failure rate as well. For many of us, I think, in the room, we will have gone through numerous rounds of treatment as well. I'm wondering, Roger, whether you think that the technology and the science is too slow, and certainly might be too slow for some of us here.
Well, it is disappointing. Absolutely, it is disappointing. And I can't explain why it's not 50% or 70% yet. And I have to say that I don't see any development that's going to bump it up that quickly. It's difficult to do research in this area. It's sensitive. There are all sorts of limitations. Limitations on the material. Just think about the egg, which is the central cell, really. I'm a feminist, you see. the mature egg is the rarest cell in the body, once a month for only 35 years or so. You can get more by injecting patients. But it's very difficult to get this material to actually study it. And so there are relatively few centers, in my opinion, even in America, or maybe especially in America, where there is really good research on this. A lot of good animal research, but not so much on the clinical side. So I absolutely agree with you, and it is, I suppose, or should be, an embarrassment that we are not further on. And one of the things that I particularly think about is the people who were the pioneers, because they were volunteering. I mean, there were hundreds of them in the early days without any evidence that it would ever work. And they were going through these horrible procedures. And so women have been extraordinary in offering themselves in those early days, even when there wasn't really any prospect. And many of them never had babies. So my hat off to people who volunteer for the research so it can move forward.
I think we've got time for one or two more questions. Oh, John Webster wants to say this. Can we get John a microphone so everyone can hear him? Since he did deliver Louise into the world, I think he deserves to be heard properly, actually. So,
Following on from this last conversation.
Closer to your mouth, John, sorry.
Following on from this conversation, to put things into perspective, what we have to appreciate, and we've known this for a long, long time, is humans are not very good reproducers. And we've also known for a long time that young, healthy couples who are trying for a baby, who are having intercourse on a regular basis, only have a 1 in 5 chance, a 25% chance of achieving a pregnancy each month. So the results get with IVF are rather better than what we get with natural conception.
John, what do you make of these schemes where companies are offering egg freezing and so on in the hope to do assisted? Do you think that seems quite a gamble to me? I don't know what you make of those sorts of things.
Well, I can understand. It was at Facebook that offered to pay for women to have their eggs frozen, the WBID employees, so they could continue with the career and start the family later on. But it is a little bit worrying.
Well, while we've got you here, John, just tell us, give us a couple of flavours of the mood in the operating theatre when that cesarean was done, and the mood after Louise. It looks like she cried instantly from the cesarean, which is pretty impressive.
Well, what I'd like to do is to go back 3 or 4 days earlier, before we did the cesarean, and Patrick and I were getting changed after operating together, when he suddenly said to me, "John, you know, this story is going to be bigger than man's landing on the moon."
It was huge.
It was a huge statement, and I didn't really know what to say to him at the time. But he didn't actually coin the phrase. He'd been at a press conference 2 or 3 days later, where Derek Jamieson was there. Remember, Derek was the editor for the Daily Express, and he was very annoyed that the Daily Mail had the exclusive.
We've got the contract
story.
On
he
on
thought,
the
every, thought every, everybody should have had a fair share of it. And in fact, he likened the situation to Louis Pasteur having been bought out by the Daily Mail, leaving the rest of us to buy our antiseptics with the Daily Mail.
Presumably, the journalists got up to all sorts of antics to get the story. I mean, just very briefly at the end, because...
For the last at least a month, the world's press had been camped outside the maternity block at Alderman District General Hospital trying to get a snippet of what was going on. And I never... Patrick had decided... He planned to do the caesarean on the 29th of July. And then on the Tuesday, the 25th, he phoned me in the morning. He said, John, meet me in theatre at 10. We're going to do the section then. And I never found out why he brought it forward. I think it might have had something to do with the press, but why he suddenly brought it forward, I don't know.
But you can confirm Louise is actually not 40 yet, isn't she?
not
you've got a little bit of time to go, Louise.
is it about 10 to 12, is it?
11:47.
13 minutes. So I think now we've got a little surprise at the end, but maybe let's see if we can squeeze in one more question. Okay, just up here.
Hiya. I'm just wondering about both of you, really. Did becoming parents yourself influence how you thought about the whole process?
Yeah, I can understand. I never sort of fully understood when Mum said that she just wanted a baby. But when I gave birth to Cameron, the feeling of holding him in my arms was just, you can't really describe it, is amazing. And that's when I fully understood what Mum said when she just wanted a baby.
Well, yes. Neither I nor my wife have had problems conceiving. My American wife is actually the embryologist for your American equivalent, the first test tube baby in America. And I think both of us were brought into this field not feeling that, you know, we were helping people who had a problem we could understand, but it was just sort of fascination with this new technology and looking at embryos. And it was later that I started to understand that people really grieve with this condition of infertility. And I think it was the same with Edwards. For Steptoe, he saw hundreds and hundreds of patients, as John would have done in his career. But for most of us in science, we never saw the suffering side.
And of course, we must think also about the couples who've tried and not succeeded, which is hard, because it's a hard, hard process. I think on that somber note, now I'm hoping we have a special guest lined up. So for a little surprise, now I should say that just after this event, we've got a mood and music event with improv and this internationally acclaimed singer, pianist and songwriter, Joe Stilgo. And I've asked Joe whether he can do happy birthday to Louise. So can we bring on Joe Stilgo? Ah, welcome, Joe Stilgo. Now, we've got to do happy birthday properly. This is a big, big birthday, Joe. So
happy birthday, Louise.
Thank you.
Hi, everyone. Okay.
So
just go for it.
Well, no. Hang on. No. You're improv. Louise, just tell me what's your favourite band?
Take that.
It is actually on your Twitter feed. So come on, Joe. Let's have a little bit of.
You just said, "Come on, no, do happy birthday."
Yeah, but come on, you're doing this event in about an hour's time. You're going to be mashing things up. So
take that.
We need a bit of take that with happy birthday.
Okay.
If you can. Any take that? There's a big, big range of songs. Come on.
Take that.
Come on, you can do it, man.
Are they in the audience?
I wish. I wouldn't be sat here if they were.
Come on, Louise. It's fine.
Today this could be the greatest day of your life. Before it's over, before we all get drunk, stay close to me. Hold on, stay close to me.
It's quite a fertile lyric, actually. I didn't know that.
Watch the world come alive tonight. Happy birthday to you.
I think that's kind of what Gary would do.
There's tons of take that. You could do something a bit more upbeat.
Okay.
A few more. Come on.
Okay,
cakes. Ah, the cake is coming out.
This could be the greatest cake of your life. With just one candle, because you're only 39. Most I've ever played at Take That. Luckily, it's only three chords.
Now, I happen to know a fascinating fact, Joe, which is when Louise was born. Does anyone know what was number one when Louise was born? You're the one that I want. That's right.
How do you know?
So Travolta and Olivia Newton, which seems very appropriate. So come on, let's have a bit of.
I was hoping it would be Mandy by Barry Manilow.
Oh,
Louise.
Okay. Come on.
I got chills. They're multiplying again. Quite fertile. That's the cake that you are holding. It's electrifying. Bear sheep up. Okay, before we do this, I think the audience has to agree they'll do the oohs.
Yeah, okay.
I'm going to make myself ridiculous in the science of this. I think you should too. How's it going? You bear sheep up.
Come on.
The wrong bit. You're the one that I want. You are the one that I want. You are the one that I Louise, the one that I want. You are the one that the one I need. Oh, please, Louise.
One last trick. Audience, fire a few suggestions for Joe. His last challenge before we wrap up proceedings. Any idea? Any suggestions for appropriate music? Tiny. Okay.
Happy birthday. It's Louise's birthday. Well, actually, 10 to 12. Hold me closer, tiny baby. Next.
I think we're going to let you off the hook now, Joe. I think let's do one regular happy thank you, Joe. You might want to join in, okay?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Louise. Happy birthday.
So thank you so much to the British Science Museum for giving me the audio to share with you. Hopefully you heard my conversation with Connie Orbach, who curated the IVF exhibition. It was really lovely chatting with her and meeting her. And I think the event was just a really great way to bring people together and get the conversation continuing about IVF. And I was chatting with some people after the talk that you just heard, which I wanted to share with you, but it was so noisy that the audio is just not up to scratch. So apologies, and thank you for you if you spoke to me. I will return to kind of normal type content. It's obviously just been a really kind of interesting week with so many options of stories I can share. And I hope your feed hasn't been too busy. Now, I just want to share a couple of my sponsors' messages with you who make this podcast possible. If you're looking for a supplement to take whilst trying to conceive, PregnaCare Conception and Wellman Conception provide advanced nutritional support. They include zinc, vitamin D, and the exact levels of folic acid recommended for women by the UK Department of Health. PregnaCare is expert nutritional care while trying for a baby. And to find out more, visit thefertilitypodcast.com/shop. The Fertility Podcast is sponsored by Infertile Life. For you, if you're trying to conceive and struggling with preparing yourself for IVF treatment, the Enhanced Fertility Programme will enable you to improve your physical and mental health and get the support you need to get pregnant faster. It's all online, and to find out how you can join today, visit infertile-life.com/EFP. If you're just finding this podcast via the fertilitypodcast.com website or social media, please do subscribe. You can do so on Apple Podcasts or Acast or Stitch or whatever your favourite podcast app is, and also via the Fertility Podcast website. And the show notes for this episode are thefertilitypodcast.com/inconversation. So I will put there the previous episode I did with Louise Brown if you want to have a little listen to that. And as always, thank you for your support and for listening. And feel free to rate and review this podcast if you fancy, either on Facebook or on Apple Podcasts. And do join my closed Facebook group, which is called Talk Fertility, if you want to chat a bit more. And do always get in touch, Natalie@thefertilitypodcast.com, if there's something I've not talked about yet. On social media, I'm at FertilityPoddy on Instagram and Twitter, and love every different possible way we can connect. Thank you for your support, as always. Until the next time.